What were you saying?
Okay. Was thinking about the first reflecting medium was water that people would have reflected on, and then that took me immediately to scene number five. And they also, she talks about the mask, the reflecting in the water.
Water, or was it wine?
It was wine. This is taking it to another level.
Oh.
But in my opinion, okay, I assume it's wine.
Mm-hmm.
And, or maybe a mixture, like mm-hmm. But still, wine is the additive, and wine would be the spirit. So, this whole image of, he's looking at the reflection of the mask. Or is he looking at the reflection of himself? And I still don't understand why it's a seder. But maybe you can address that.
Well, I just guess it is.
Right.
Seder is, which one's the seder?
Both of them are seders. He's holding the mask, and this seder is looking into the reflection.
Well, I only remember barely, I think, what she said, and I confess these pictures are out of my league, but that the key was what he's seeing is Dionysus, which is emptiness.
Oh, right.
And that the wine is spirit, and this is seeing that spirit is not only, you know, rah, rah, party boy, but it's also emptiness. No, I think it's that emptiness is Dionysian too. That is something
right.
We do not understand.
And that there's a fullness that comes out of that emptiness.
Yeah, right.
I think is what she talked about.
Right, yeah. And the reason it's seders is, well, I'm doing it badly, of course, but that this is nature. Because this was clearly in competition with Christianity, which was spirit.
So except in art, nature being part animal or whatever?
Well, or the way to accept our animal is to realize the spirit in emptiness and the emptiness in spirit. It's a complete paradox, but that's why it's in images and not in prose. Yeah, that's what I remember. But I could be off. But I think it's phenomenal, whatever it is.
It's curious that it's nature seeing his own reflection. Like, you know, that's very interesting.
Like,
that it's nature that's seeing.
He looks in it, but he doesn't really see himself.
He doesn't see himself, right.
He doesn't see himself as he is. He sees himself how the God sees him. Isn't Dionysus considered a God figure there?
Yeah.
She addresses the mask.
Well, and remember that there's no eyes behind the mask.
Right. There's no eyes.
Yeah, it's an empty mask. And even at the IMA, I think there's a Dionysian sculpture next to the Lily Mansion. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah. Just like that. And there's no eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I think very often Dionysus was depicted as a mask over emptiness. Mm-hmm. But not over emptiness, a mask through which emptiness
came through. Yeah. Ooh. It comes through the eyes. The emptiness comes through the eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is part of the process that, you know.
Right.
And it's interesting. I have to hear this over and over.
Well, me too. I mean, I think it's a myth of our time. It contains, remember, like Christianity smashed Gnosticism and also smashed this. And its idea of redemption was spirit and up. This idea of redemption is spirit and down. And it's a huge difference.
Dionysus is a body experience.
Right.
It's not a spirit in the body, and that could be why there's dangers too.
Yeah, I think, you know, this dream we just read, I think you could say the emptiness would be whatever he decides is going to be wrong. He would like to be with a woman and dump his family. Then he misses his family. He would like to be with his family and get rid of this obsession. Then he'd miss the obsession. If he accepts both, he's not going to have either fully. And so that part of coming to consciousness of the self is accepting the emptiness of what we've chosen, which is not a bad thing. See, we think emptiness is a bad thing, but I think they're saying, no, it's not a bad thing. It's part of it.
Isn't that what Jim is going through in this red book right now?
Yeah. Definitely.
Thank you. It's so clean.
Yeah. Oh, you saw it dirty, huh?
It's so dirty.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah. No, it protects it.
Oh, it protects it, yeah.
Because that's the protection for us. Because they turn the light off. Yeah, they do have some broken, neighbored window coverings there, but there are no, it's not closed off. It just is exposed to the elements, to the air, and
I'm going away for a week shortly, and I hope to work on this.
Awesome.
Okay, thank you.
Else in your toy box over there that you can
see? Oh, yeah, that's more show and tell.
There's more stuff down there. I could go through the whole list. We really need to take a whole salary session.
Go ahead, I don't care.
Yeah? Are you serious?
Between this book and the next.
That would be, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right. And why don't you bring in what she says about some of these things? She says it.
She does.
Better than me.
She does.
And she is a poet in her own right, the way she puts it. A woman wrote a book about these.
She was an analyst. She was an analyst, and so she looked at these from a psychological perspective. Oh, okay.
Show and tell. It's like kindergarten.
It's better than kindergarten.
Yep.
It's kindergarten for adults.
Boy, yeah. Kindergarten's underrated.
That's what we could put on our t-shirts. Kindergarten is underrated. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, don't tell us anymore now. Like, the whole show all at once.
Yeah.
That's
fabulous.
That would be a beautiful ending to talk about how these, well, not just how these ideas, but talk about that stuff when we build a bridge to this stuff.
Right.
Because we'll be doing our art next time around.
Perfect segue.
Yeah. And he goes through his own.
And he goes through his own darkness, filled with fire. It's he must have been supercharged.
Do you think that if children, infants, the adults, have the relationship with mother like they're supposed to, that they experience that intimacy as an infant?
I guess so, yeah.
I was actually reading about, I can't think of the name of the book, but he was quoting another psychologist, and like if the mother's gone for X amount of time, the baby kind of has this image of the mother. But if she's, and then the baby's okay. But if she's gone X plus Y amount of time, the baby's in distress. You know, but the baby recovers. But if she's gone for X plus Y plus Z amount of time, the baby loses its sense of identity and actually then understands what madness is, because it has lost a sense of continuity with itself because of the loss of the mother. And that
I think that's what makes people, you know, psychotic and things like that. Like they've lost that sense of continuity. That the baby can only tolerate that sense of emptiness for a very limited period of time. And that very famous psychologist that had that wrote about that out.
And that gets back to the whole idea of the mirror and what the mother does, because touching the baby, looking at the baby, it tells the child, this is who you are, by touching their body. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I remember the Peace Corps. We visited an orphanage. It was so despairing to see these kids. Little babies, just sad. Mm-hmm. Sad.
Yeah.
6 months old. Mm-hmm. Not crying, just sad. Mm-hmm. And that must be what they were going through.
Yeah.
Despair.
Despair. Yeah, despair in a 6 month old.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah. Okay, let's see. I don't know if we need to go through her interpretation. It's kind of clear, maybe. What the teacher is, this is on 176. The two angels, that's all clear, I think, huh?
Uh-huh.
The non-egocentric aspect of individuation. Well, okay, so 172, she just starts putting the words in her beautiful way, what I've been struggling to say.
We're going back to 172?
177. One might describe, see three lines down? This, meaning the fact that the self has an extroverted function, describe this as the social function of the self. Each person gathers around him his own soul family, a group of people not created by accident or by mere egotistic motivation, but rather through a deeper, more essential spiritual interest or concern, reciprocal individuation. That's pretty much what we've been saying. So I think we can go down to the along, in that last paragraph there. Interesting conclusion to this chapter, which in a way gives me hope, and in a way sobers me. Along with the mythologem of recollecting the light sparks, there is another motif of archetypal images that refers to the coming together of certain people through the agency of the self. It is the motif of the round table. And then I skip a little bit. She quotes the Castel St. Graal, which is one of the versions of the Grail legend. You know, there are, I don't know, three or four or five of them. That there are three tables. There's the table of the Last Supper. There's the table of the Holy Grail, and there's the round table. Now, why I think that is so important is in the next paragraph. In the fifth surah of the Quran, verses so on, God sends a table from heaven to Jesus and his apostles, and on it lies a fish as a sign he will feed them. As a result of humanity's sinfulness, however, this table is taken away again by God. So, what that says to me is this idea that I have put out, that we might be coming to, in the next 100, 200 years, whatever, to a new understanding of relationship. Just like men and women have changed their relationship, maybe our ideas about each other and about how we get involved with the world may shift.
Now, how are you?
Well,
what are your in-between thoughts there? How does this speak to you with that?
Because we see in this text that the table was given but taken away. So that everything I've said up to now is for the moment probably impossible. But maybe we'll get
a community part.
Yeah. But maybe we'll get a second chance. If we have an image of something, then that gives me hope.
So this is from the Quran, and when was that written?
Well, it was 800, John, is that? Quran?
Quran, that was dates back to 1600.
600.
Although the earliest extant texts are older than that.
Are they?
Probably from
800. 880, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So old.
So perhaps, I mean, that was taken away then.
Right.
So that's an image from then.
Right.
We've developed somewhat
right
at that time, so maybe we're starting to see the effects of the table coming back.
And what if it speaks to the relationship between Christianity and Islam? Mm-hmm.
Good. Good. In other words, I guess what's hopeful, if it was given once, then it is a possibility. Yes, it's been taken away, but maybe it can be given again. At what she is describing is not totally impossible, since it existed as an image at one time. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm grasping at straws, but I have to think we're in pretty tough straits right now.
But it was also taken away from a God and had a certain view of humanity's sinfulness. So maybe as the image of God changes. As our
could be.
Image changes, then
could be. Could very well be. But I just find this stuff amazing. I don't know if it hits you the same way or not. But this is a whole new grasp of relationship, mm-hmm. of social caring, of history. Whether we can realize it is a big question, but I think we would be stupid to think it's going to be easy. I think we would be stupid to say it's impossible. Will we see it in our lifetime? Who knows? But why not contribute as best we can to its unfolding if there's a chance?
You know, when we were starting earlier, I was thinking of that point you brought up about, you know, primates, and not just primates, a lot of other species have that mirroring, and then I just realized mirroring.
Yeah, the neuron. Yeah. And not just the neuron, but the neuron. I want to take a breath before we jump to the next one. You okay so far? This next chapter is kind of hard. Part of it repeats. Part of it introduces new material. And what she's doing, just to put it in the thread, is we are now talking about what we have accomplished if we are able to integrate our projections. If we can establish a relationship with the self. And remember this, what I call the Gnostic model, is one model. Here's what the result is. And the result is a conscious relationship to the self. And then she goes on, so what is a conscious relationship to the self like? It's one take on it. I just thought of the other model of the self. It's psychology of the transference, Eros. I think the phrase for Gnostic, alchemical, answer to Job, and psychology of transports. Where the four way he talks about the self coming to consciousness, but not mutually exclusive, but they're kind of different angles.
What was number four again?
Psychology of transports, Eros. It comes through Eros.
That's first?
Yeah. And you could say, well, isn't transference like not? Yes. I mean, they overlap. But there's just kind of different angles to the thing. I just wanted to throw that out. So the point now is to follow up on this reciprocal relation between ego and self. That's, I'm trying to give you the forest before we jump into the trees. Ego focuses on unconscious projections, which activates the self, which focuses on us. And they are, it's a dialectic. That's what she's doing in this chapter. And looking at all the aspects of the self. And she takes her sweet time getting there. The first thing she talks about is just consciousness growing, period. 179. And this really is almost, I mean, we're sort of taking a detour now. But she mentioned something which isn't, I don't think, critical to the book, but that action often, or maybe always, precedes consciousness. The idea is that our deepest ideas about life came out of ritual. Rituals are stories, but they're stories that are enacted. And when they're in their birth stage, nobody stops and says, what's the theology of this ritual? It's lived. It's lived as a desire to act. Remember, did I tell you about that story of that little old lady in France and the frescoes? None of you have heard it. Bear with me, if you will. We were biking through rural France a couple of years ago, and my friend's partner said, there are some marvelous frescoes in the bottom of this church. Let's see if we can go look at it. So it was around noon, and we did a real sin, and my friend knocked on somebody's door. You don't do that. You don't interrupt people at lunch because they're either eating or making love. So she knocked on the door anyway. And the concierge of this little church came to the door, and I'll embellish the story a little bit, and saw that we were biking. Well, that gave us a big plus. And for some reason, the fact that I was an American was a big plus, and that we wanted to see this church. She said, well, normally I don't do this, but I'll show you the crypt. So she took us down to this basement area, which was about 5 feet tall, so we were like this. And the church had been struck by lightning, so we had to have a flashlight. So we went down there, and there were these marvelous frescoes from probably the 12th century that were just absolutely childlike. I mean, they were not fine art. There was somebody inspired to paint the crucifixion and then the saints. And we were just so blown away by this. I mean, it was like, I've never seen anything so raw and beautiful at the same time. And the woman could feel our appreciation. So she had a flashlight. So she turned off the flashlight. We knew to be quiet. So we just stood there for about 5 minutes in quiet. She said to us, you really appreciate these, don't you? And we, oh, yeah, yeah. She said, well, I'll tell you a secret. When your heart is heavy with care, I can't even say this, I'm not getting touched. And you come here at night and you wait. These saints of the Lord, they come alive. They will give you things. See, for her, it wasn't a matter of belief. It was raw experience. And that's what she's trying to get at, that what we now theologize, well, Christ stands for this, Mark stands for this, was once immediate experience. And so that ritual precedes understanding. That is her point. And that real truths come out of those kind of experiences. They don't come out of concepts. So it's not really critical to the argument, but she's kind of tracing how consciousness emerges first in action, in ritual action, as momentary flashes of consciousness, without necessarily having continuity to it. Then she makes a detour to physics. Now, we have scientists here, I think, at least two. And we have scientists here, at least two.
Mm-hmm.
You, that would be you.
You.
She talks about crystal structures. Now, I don't totally understand that. Do you guys understand that stuff?
I know a little bit about it.
Yeah.
So, which paragraph are you?
Well, she's going to physics as an example of structures that support reflection. And so she's talking on page 182 how lattice structures apparently reflect light where non-lattice structures do not. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it could be, that would be like a piece of mica.
Yeah.
Or quartz.
Yeah.
Things have a lattice structure, whereas a rock does not. So
right.
The rock doesn't tend to
reflect. Now, what is a lattice structure, and how does it come into being?
Yeah, it's actually, instead of sort of just a random collection of molecules, it's actually a coherent structure,
right,
like a bunch of tinker toys. So if you could imagine, sort of on a molecular level, like a crystal would be like a bunch of tinker toys, you know, put together into like a box with different interstices at regular intervals, you know, and they all lay in the same plane, which is a lot, which allows reflection. As opposed to a pile of tinker toys, you know, everything's in different planes, so there can be no reflection. Like, light is reflected in every different direction, whereas if you have things like a bunch of crystals or molecules lined up in the same plane, then light will be reflected back from that plane, and you'll see it.
Why would one substance have the molecules arranged in a lattice and others not?
I mean, part of it is the characteristic of the molecule.
Uh-huh.
Like silicone and quartz and things like that tend to align themselves in crystal structures.
Just because they do.
Because they do.
Uh-huh.
And then also part of it is in like how the process occurs. Like if, like with certain amount of water and evaporation, you know, then crystals can form.
I see. Yeah.
You know, in other situations, you just get mud.
Because you got snowflakes, which are crystalline.
Correct.
You got water, which is not crystalline.
Correct. And then, yeah, and you can get hail, which isn't exactly the same as a crystalline structure. It's the same substance, it just formed under different circumstances, and it doesn't have the same lattice structure.
Okay.
So it's a characteristic both of the type of molecule and the origins of its birth that allow it to either have reflective qualities or not.
So it must have a certain number of electrons in its outer ring, huh? Is that part of it?
Correct.
Yeah.
Like if you, like the difference between, I'm trying to think of a good example, like different forms of certain substances. Like you can have iron as a salt, which is rust. And you can have iron which doesn't have, it's not missing an electron, so it has no charge, and it's that metal thing over there. You
know, uh-huh.
Different
forms. So iron can be a crystal, can be a crystalline structure.
Depending on the number of electrons,
I see.
It can be a solid molecular structure, or it can be a salt.
I saw
it. Which is, it's missing an electron,
yeah,
so it attracts to something else, and then that forms a different substance.
Right.
So the number of electrons that it has determine its, both its reactivity and its appearance.
Okay. Well, the reason she's not really giving us anything new here. She's returning to some more old ideas, but I think she's putting it in a very interesting way. Instead of going to myth to make her point, she goes to science. She goes to physics. And she says the self's ability to support our insight is analogous to a crystalline structure's ability to reflect light. And the point is that reflection requires a previous structure. Self in us and the lattice in crystalline structure in a piece of material. It's nothing new. It's just she's going to a different image. But I always like to see how she thinks with science. She takes science as much a metaphor as she does myth.
And I think like a diamond is actually a great example as an image of the self, that a diamond is just a bunch of carbon. You know?
Uh-huh.
But if you put it under intense pressure, you know, then it forms, the carbon forms a diamond. You know, and if you don't, it's a lump of coal, you know, so that sort of is analogous to the self.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways that like, that's how we find ourselves, is that, you know, we develop under intense pressure.
Absolutely.
Just a bloody lump of coal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And
yeah.
my,
my friend who analyzed our piece talks about it as being the crystal is ordered. There's an order
yes.
there.
Well, why don't you tell us what's relevant to it?
Well, I don't know if I can explain it.
I don't know.
Basically, to explain a lot of the tests that they did on this piece that we brought back from Pompeii, he gave me a whole lecture on the difference between glass and crystal mm-hmm. and how that looks, sent me images of how that looks at an atomic level when they run the test. And basically just that crystal has an ordered set of rings. The crystal ring looks a certain way. It sounds a certain way. So when you hit crystal, it has a vibration.
Pure vibration. Yeah.
Right, but if you just hit glass, it doesn't vibrate like that because it's amorphous. So that whole idea of order and non-order fits very well with this whole idea of the lattice structure, mm-hmm. which brings me to Carol's one painting of the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole idea of that order. Do you have that picture?
With me? No, I hadn't thought about it. There is a lot of order in that death.
And that could come for our show and tell.
Yeah.
Those of us who haven't seen it or seen it, maybe it could come for show and tell.
Oh, okay.
Or an image thereof.
That's a good point.
Yeah, we'll wait next week for show it. Because we'll get through I don't think we'll need all of next week to finish the book.
So the whole idea of all these pieces
yeah,
of ourselves
right.
coming into some kind of order that allows the self to come forth.
Well, and conversely, that for insight to really work, there has to be a structure there to begin with. So, and how we create that structure by working on our projection. And this is, she's already said this.
So is it just finding the structure? Because is the structure a priori?
The structure would be a priori.
It'd be a priori.
And that's the thing with crystals, is each crystal kind of is unique, but the structure is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an a priori
structure. It's a priori, but it's activated.
Individual crystals use that structure, but in individual ways.
Yeah, but
each crystal looks different.
Right.
And on the microscopic level, there's a certain level which they all look the same, but then mm-hmm. the growth structure all looks completely unique.
Go out in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there
is the molecular level, if you get small enough, the basic, like they're all made out of the same building blocks, you know, mm-hmm. like or that particular crystal, all the basic units will look the same if you focus close enough.
Yeah, that's complexity theory, I think, mm-hmm. isn't it? In terms of a priori, I think what she's driving at is, and again, it's just a metaphor. She's giving us another metaphor, that the structure is there in potential, but it has to be activated.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't make the effort, it won't activate. It's this idea of provoked grace. That's a phrase that came from the living symbol, that we have to take the steps, but it doesn't respond.
What did you bring back from? We brought back little pieces of, what are they called? Papillae?
Mm-hmm.
Volcanic
material.
Mm-hmm. Which covered most of Pompeii along with ash. And we brought some of that back.
I see. Yeah.
And surprisingly, it was very lightweight.
Very light.
And that's why they found argon, a high level of argon gas. Trapped inside. And argon just exists, but I'm wondering, and he couldn't tell me because he's not a volcanologist, but if at an eruption there would be more argon gas.
So I was wondering, they got trapped and was molten.
These would have had to cool extremely quickly.
Yeah, well, and that's what he says here.
Yeah.
That they, when they were expelled, then they were, let's see, found high levels of argon gas trapped in the sample, much higher than would be found in the air. The minerals that we were able to see in the small amount of crystals found are quartz, which is crystalline silica, kunkanite, and anorthite. These are all reported in the literature for Pompeii. So I would conclude the material was ejected very rapidly out of the volcano and cooled on the way down to a hot solid before it landed. The only mystery for me was the chlorine trapped in the sample. It suggests that the sample was exposed to seawater at the time, or maybe later. By the way, the color brown is from the iron oxide in the sample.
Because it's covered with brown substance. Yeah. But we were wondering if perhaps when they excavated, they didn't dump some of that stuff in the ocean.
Some of the material that went into the ocean was brought back in by the tides because that stuff floats on land.
Well, and their theory now is that there was some kind of a tsunami that happened. And so we have no idea how hot.
Could have all been covered with water at the moment.
So is chlorine in seawater?
Yeah. Salt.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so the chemists all were just like, everybody was making bets about what was going to be in there and passing it around. And so they had a great fun with it.
But you have a piece of history with you.
Yes.
Huh? From
yes.
You know that came out of that volcano. Yeah. That's freaky.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the, they had planters going into the hotel. And these were just like, we would use mulch. They mm-hmm. were just in there.
Yeah. Well, so we could just take them.
Wow.
Just, they were abundant.
Well, you could show and tell those next time.
It shows how incredibly powerful, always many years later, that there was that much on that last book.
Yeah,
they were still so abundant that they use it just for anything.
Okay, back to 182. Just, again, she's sort of recapitulating, building her way to the real main point of this chapter, which is that fourfold mirroring. So we're just kind of revisiting some old ideas. She went through that metaphor of the lattice to repeat the point that the ability to reflect is based on a prior condition of the benevolence of the self allowing reflection. Now that may sound silly to you, but if you've ever struggled against your own repetitive patterns where you don't see, you say, how did I get into that again? Well, reflection is not always to be taken for granted. So she's aware of that and just saying, there's a certain precondition for the ability to reflect, and that is some prior inner work and some presence of the self. And so all she's doing now is just saying, oh, let's just talk a little bit about what consciousness is. She's not talking about consciousness of anything in particular, just how is it that we can have consciousness. And remember that she's talking about the mirror as reflecting, which is consciousness. She talks a little bit about water as the early image for reflection.
Where are you
going? Well, I'm just sort of skimming because these are all repetitive points. Bottom 183, psychologically, water is one of the most frequent symbols of the unconscious, and hence the depths of the water were thought of in many places as the source of all prophecy and of use in seeing phenomenon from the beyond. Again, just looking at generally what is insight, what is consciousness.
What I'd like to, she talks about fear masks, which I think okay. is definitely with this.
Okay, where are you, Sandy?
At the middle paragraph on 183.
Okay. Want to read it?
A similar purpose is served by fear masks, that is, revolting and evil-looking, distorted faces that show a demon his own image from which he flees in terror. So and so that took me back to her. Is she going to flee? Or is she going to face? So that was a question going around my head when
yeah.
I read this.
Right, and you can see in the previous scene in the villa where she's almost trying to, it's the only place where she's almost stepping out of the scene. And you have to look really closely at her foot coming out of this green piece back here. So there's a lot of fear here at the reflection.
Mm-hmm. There's that piece. Yeah. She's stepping out. She actually has her.
Well, she looks alarmed. Mm-hmm.
Just the point that von Franz is making in that light is the really the healing power of being able to name something. Mm-hmm. If you, that's what I was saying with that table. Once you've got an image of whatever it is that's tormenting you, you're halfway there. Mm-hmm. It's when you can't symbolize something that it has power over you. But once you symbolize it, mm-hmm. you can start having power over it.
It's the fairy tale of Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
Names
yeah.
Blows up or
destroys himself. Yeah. And of course, that for us is why we do dream work. That's what an image is. And it may take a long time before we can get the thing under control, but at least if you know what you're dealing with, I think you're ahead of the game than when you don't. And there's some hope that comes in. So again, all she's doing. Is sort of laying the groundwork for the big section here. Anything else before we go on? A sentence that's kind of rich is on 185, the last two sentences, or I'll say the last four lines of that top paragraph. She's going to be looking now at something she's introduced, but she'll be looking at it more closely. The nature of reflection when we see the self, and the nature of reflection when the self sees us. That understanding is an understanding in two dimensions. That, so that last sentence, the mirroring is also by way of the symbolic image that has a place in both worlds. We have to understand it, and it has to show itself to us from the unconscious. And neither one is self-evident. And we have a show and tell.
And I showed this in the class on Thursday, but I was very much taken by thresholds this time. So I took a bunch of pictures of thresholds in the Bellevue Mysteries. This particular one came out, and I didn't see it at the time, but it looks like an eye. And I was wondering about the threshold. And this is actually, I'm standing in the room that that the initiate would have come into before she went into this room, which is where the frescoes are.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that would be right here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This is where that
would be right there. Mm-hmm. There's a door right there.
So there's an eye and threshold. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And standing in between two, both worlds.
Mm-hmm. That's astounding.
Yeah. True.
And then it's the empty piece there, too.
Yeah, that is going to be, now this is what she's going to be pursuing, that very idea. The eye is a threshold, and the eye in both worlds. And I think it's just so important when you have a dream in which you know you are seen, and that seer knows who you are and knows to the extent to which you are who you are and the extent to which you are not who you are. It's a shock. And you realize that identity is not merely subjective. And that just, with my fascination with my training still after all these years, that's the feeling I had talking to her, that she knew to what extent I was who I was and to what extent I wasn't who I was. And that is scary.
Just intuitively.
Intuitively. And not only knew, but one felt her emotions reacting to the real part of you and to the part of you that was not yet real. And with both, I hate the word criticism. If you can think of criticism as supportive, with criticism and with acceptance and with a certain sense of humor. That a very strange experience. And I can only imagine that's what Jung must have been like and why he was so effective as a therapist. She paid a terrible price. I don't know how she got there. But that was my feeling. So it's this dimension that is, I think, so far to us. We are largely egos. And this is trying to move into selfhood, which is a different level of authenticity. Maybe I could put it that way. So I think pretty much repeat, repeat, repeat. She alludes to objective, not objective, what's he called? He talks about knowledge that's absolute knowledge. The dream of the businessman. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of absolute knowledge. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we come to the main part of the chapter. It might be a place to stop. What she's going to do in this chapter to end the book, or in this section, really, to end the book, is look at this relationship for relationships in the process of mirroring. When the ego mirrors the self, and the self mirrors the ego. When matter mirrors the self, and when the self mirrors matter. The latter two have to do with synchronicity and science. That's where we'll go. So, do we have enough show and tell that we want to spend the time next week? We'll finish this. We can have show and tell. We can start Burkhuizer, or we cannot start Burkhuizer, as you wish.
We won't have
time. You think we'll have enough show and tell?
I mean, just to kind of go back and review, and then do it.
Okay, so we'll review.
Yeah, I don't think
we'll review. Yeah. We'll finish. Mm-hmm. We'll review, show and tell, and then we'll start Burkhuizer the week after that. Okay, we've earned it.
And also,
we can really cook too. Yeah, really. That's a bonus in my world.
And also, we have that bottle of wine that we never opened. That Jen
for the barrel.
No. This is here. Okay. Yeah, I'll bring it.
Oh,
lovely.
Well, it's been quite an adventure. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have gotten a lot out of it. So I'll see you in 2 weeks.